P.D. James, the great detective mystery writer and Baroness of Holland Park, is our guest on the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell had posed a question about what's happening in the United Kingdom.
Well, Bill was asking about the House of Lords specifically, wasn't he, and the changes. And he's right. When I was a child, up till the last war, the House of Lords consisted of lords, of the hereditary aristocracy, of dukes and earls and barons. And they sat there because they were peers of the realm, and father and son succeeded father. Well, I think there was a feeling that, after all, they were part of the government of the country, and there was a feeling, I think, of all parties, that somehow you can't really justify this in a modern democracy. You really can't justify people being able to sit in the House of Lords simply because they are a duke and their father was a duke before them. And the first reform was to make life peers, of which I'm one. That is, the Queen made people peers of the realm with exactly the same rights and privilege, the same robes, the same... and you all have your coat of arms, you are a peer of the realm, but you can't pass it on to a child. And, of course, you could only pass it on to sons anyway. So if you had a son, you couldn't pass it on. So that was one reform, and life peers came into the house. Then this government decided that no hereditary peers ought to remain at all. But they have a partial reform. The peers who did sit there elected 91 of their members. They had their own little private election under this Act of Parliament to decide who should stay. And there are still 91 of them, which is quite a number. And, of course, as they were elected by the hereditary peers, by all peers, I think, we could vote them, they tend to be the ones who have been the most useful in the House and most regular in their attendance and, in fact, extremely useful and knowledgeable members of the House. But I think the government's eventual plan is that no hereditaries will remain. But of course, I mustn't go on too long about this and bore your listeners, but the problem is, if you start reforming any further, how do people get into the House of Lords? Well, logically, in a democracy, they are elected. But of course, if they are elected, the House of Lords will have equal power, equal authority with the House of Commons. At the moment, we haven't. The power has to reside in the House of Commons. And we can turn down a bill three times, but the third time, the Commons can evoke an Act of Parliament which will say that will now become law, whether the Lords like it or not, because we are the democratically elected House. But if the Lords are democratically elected, the Lords can say, we are elected just as you are. And how do you elect them? If you just have a general election, everybody say who you want to be in the House of Lords, I have an unfortunate feeling it'll be pop stars and footballers. So, you know, the Commons is not very keen on an elected House of Lords, really, and with some reason. But if they're not elected, then you get the old system. I mean, is it any better to be there because you are a favourite of the present Prime Minister than if you were aware because your great-great-great-great, you're there because your great-great-great-great-grandfather was a favourite of the then king? It's patronage.
There is that.
It's patronage, whichever way you look at it. So it's obviously it's a difficult problem.
Well, I ask that. I mean, this is not just voyeurism, because the American system of government is predicated, as you said, substantially on the English model. And we forget that democracy is an evolving process. We tend to assume that what we have is fixed, and the amount of change and the velocity of change going on in England is striking. And the kinds of things you're talking about, the checks and balances that we're very proud of here, not only between the various branches, but between the two legislative branches, is something we make a great deal about. And it's the same kinds of issues that you're dealing with. And at the very least, it seems there is learning that we can take, we as Americans can take from the challenges that you're trying to address in England.
Yes, and of course we now have, some of those changes have been the setting up of two legislatures, the Scottish Parliament and the Welsh Assembly, so that those two countries now have a great deal of power devolved to their own establishments. sorry, that has created a problem, because the Scots now have their own Parliament, and everything other than defence, I think, and foreign affairs is devolved to them. But they still sit at Westminster, having a say in our concerns over matters which are devolved to Scotland. So England, of course, feels a little hard done by. You know, come on, we say, we have no say in their educational system. So why can they come down and vote about our educational system? So that hasn't really been perhaps as carefully thought through. I mean, there are problems that haven't yet been tackled.
But how does one learn if one doesn't tackle the problems?
Oh, yes, you've got it. I mean, Scotland has always wanted, and of course, until we had the Act of Union at the time of James I, it was a separate country and did have its own king. And in fact, we with James I, had a Scottish king who united the two countries.
Well, and there are nationalist parties both in Scotland and Wales that would like very much to make
they
the
would
binds
like to be
even less.
Separate. Oh, yes, Scotland would like to. I don't think Wales so much. You see, only one in five Welsh people even voted for the Welsh Assembly. It's extraordinary. Very often these, you know, I do think some of these so-called reforms are driven by very, very committed minorities who want them very much. I mean, you'd hardly say
sort of
Welsh
like the
people.
Sort of like the American Revolution, wouldn't you say?
Exactly. I mean, probably much the same, because, I mean, you'd hardly think the Welsh people were mad keen on having their assembly when only one in five of them bothered to vote for it. Yeah. You could well argue that if the others weren't keen on it, that the majority on the whole didn't want it. And, of course, as soon as you set these things up, you have a vast increase in money in bureaucracy, of course. Mm-hmm. But still, I'm not saying that either of these were wrong, and certainly I think Scottish one was necessary, and we certainly are changing in many ways as a country as far as our constitution. Of course, we haven't got a written constitution like you. You see, nothing is written down at all, which is interesting. But we've got the same situation, I think, as you may have under our system of voting. We haven't got proportional representation, so that nearly always we get a government which most of the people didn't vote for. The constituencies, you know, as you have states, we have constituencies, and whoever wins that constituency goes to Parliament.
Winner takes all.
But when you look at the national vote, and Tony Blair got, present Prime Minister, an astonishing majority on less votes than John Major got at the previous election. It's these are, you know, there's some demand that you have something a little more democratic, a little fairer. But of course, once you get that, then you get all these, you know, different parties, and nothing ever gets done.
Part of why I find this interesting is because you have a real interest in the Victorian era, when things were as different from now in some ways as they were different 800 years ago. Yes. And so your sense of continuity through, and of course the empire at the time of Victorian
absolutely
England.
Absolutely staggeringly great.
And it has all changed so dramatically. Surely no country has changed anymore.
I don't think any country can have changed as much. Because looking back to my childhood, and I was born in 1920, when I was at my elementary school, it's called the first state school, there was a huge map of the world. And huge portions of it were ruled directly from Westminster, and they were red. I mean, this was before the Dominion Act. So Canada and India and Australia and New Zealand and South Africa were just there, solidly red, ruled from Westminster. And as I said, it's an empire in which the sun never set. Now, of course, they're all independent. We've got the Commonwealth, but they're all independent countries, and we have shrunk, and our treasure, of course, greatly shrunk during the Second World War.
But your character grew.
Well, let's say our character was tested.
Ah, indeed. Mm-hmm. So we won't go too far more without talking about character. You tend to set your books by setting, but all of these things of which we speak end up in your detective stories. Not only do you tell us about these things in wonderful ways so that all of the obvious questions need not be asked, you've already answered them eloquently in your fragment of an autobiography, which also, it seemed to me, gave you a chance to tell me what you think, how you think it, and how you came to these things. And then I go back and I look at these wonderful, I think of them as mysteries, detective stories, and I see the world, a world that you have created. Now, there are elements of intersection with how you see it and how other people experience it. But I began to have this sense that you really are creating alternate universes. But it starts in settings that are familiar. Now, how do you reconcile the alien and the familiar as you create these worlds?
Well, I like the books to be set in their own time, unambiguously in their own time. I'm not really a didactic writer, so I don't set out, as it were, to write about social problems. But inevitably, I think if you're trying to write honestly about your own time, all sorts of issues come up. I mean, in the last book, Taste for Justice, the problem with the Metropolitan Police, the lack of morale, because there was a report called the McPherson Report, which was an inquiry by a judge following an unsuccessful murder investigation of a racial crime, which said that the Metropolitan Police suffered from institutionalized racism. Well, who knows exactly what that word means, but certainly the thousands of policemen who were not racists felt, you know, very much maligned, and
time you get to Death by Holy Orders, yeah. I didn't say that right, in yes. Holy Orders, yes. you still yes. have your officers dealing with this.
Yes, especially Kate, who wonders whether she'll want to stay. Now, that's a very modern part, you know, of a police officer's thinking, a Metropolitan Police officer's thinking at the moment. And, of course, we have here the murder of a very unpopular archdeacon, but some of the reasons why he's unpopular are to do with some differences of opinion of what the priesthood means in the Church of England. So it's very much set. I mean, I think people reading it would know the year in which actually it was set, and I think that's tremendously important.
And you smile when you say it.
Yes.
We will be back in just a moment with Lady P.D. James. There's a great deal more to be said, of course. Bill Russell is sitting here wanting to jump straight away. Please be with us when we return with the Paula Gordon Show, with the great honor of having Lady P.D. James as our guest.